This episode of the MedTalk podcast is brought to you by MedTech Innovation Expo, the UK and Ireland's leading event for medical device manufacturing. Save the date for MedTech Innovation Expo 2024, taking place on the 5th and 6th of June at the NEC in Birmingham. For more information, please visit www.medtechexpo.com. Hello and welcome to this episode of the MedTalk podcast, where we discuss the latest news and issues in life sciences. I'm Ian Bolland, the Group Content Manager for Rapid MedTech. On this episode, I'm joined by Rolly Carlson, who's the CEO of Immune Express, and he provides some insight into the challenges of diagnosing sepsis. Plus, he tells us about the technology that his company is developing to try and address this. So, Rolly, thank you very much for joining us on the MedTalk podcast. To start with, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and about Immune Express?
Well, Ian, thank you for the opportunity. So Rolly Carlson, I'm the CEO of Immune Express. I've been in the medical biotech field for a good 30 years. Originally started at Abbott Laboratories, where I had the opportunity to run both custom pharmaceutical businesses and also diagnostic businesses as well. After leaving Abbott, over the past 13 years, I've been part of three to four startups as a founder and CEO of a diagnostic company in Austin, Texas called Asuragen. We spun out a therapeutic company called Myrna Therapeutics, or miRNA, before RNA therapeutics were really the hot thing as far as vaccines were concerned. I was a public CEO for a NASDAQ company called Wavergen Biosystems in San Francisco. All of these companies, by the way, either went public or were sold to larger entities. And now I'm CEO of Immune Express, which is based in Seattle.
Okay, just give us a little bit of insight into Immune Express, because having looked at the website and the briefing I've had beforehand, at the moment you seem to be specialising in sepsis diagnostics. First of all, I mean, obviously our entire audience probably will know what sepsis is, but probably won't know it in as great a detail as yourself. So if we can start there as to about the challenges of diagnosing sepsis and your technology in particular.
Sure. Well, the company was founded actually in Australia and was a biomarker discovery company looking for biomarkers associated with infectious disease, and found some very interesting gene technology that was associated specifically with sepsis. And we moved to Seattle to do the clinical development of the products that we'll talk about in future. But sepsis itself is a life-threatening organ dysfunction that's due to a dysregulated host response to an infection. And in simple terms, basically there's a bloodstream infection due to a pathogen. Could be viral, bacterial, it could be fungal as well. And the body actually hyper response to that. There's a hyperimmune response to that infection. And then, so what we start having is a systemic inflammatory response. And what is unfortunately the life-threatening part of this, an organ dysfunction, is actually your body sort of attacking itself. And there's a cascade of events, an immune response, that ultimately starts affecting organs, organ dysfunction. You have leaking of veins, capillaries, et cetera, like that, and then it could it could actually result in death. Sepsis is a global healthcare problem worldwide. There's about over 48 million cases per year, with 11 million deaths. WHO says that one in five deaths are caused by sepsis, and in the hospital environment is the leading cause of death, number one cause of death in both in Europe and the US. It's the most expensive condition to treat because there's multiple modalities going on. And it's also one of the biggest cost factors for treatment in hospitals. But the incidence rate is really only about 6%. Mm-hmm. So, and despite this awareness that sepsis is really a significant problem, mortality rates are increasing. The incidence rate of sepsis is increasing. So we really need to have technologies that are able to help be able to turn the tide, so to speak, to reduce mortality rates and morbidity. If a patient does survive, it can actually, you know, can result in multiple amputeeism. I mean, more high morbidity for a lifetime.
Taking all of that into account, what you said in terms of morbidity rate and the cost that it incurs on healthcare systems, I just want to come back to diagnosing and getting treating it itself. How difficult is it to diagnose? Because everyone's increasingly aware of it. You'd think there'd be a correlation between awareness and ease of diagnosis, so to speak. But obviously, I realize that isn't always the case. So how difficult is it to diagnose?
Well, you know, in the later stage, it's very easy when you start having your organ dysfunction, and at that point in time, it's easy to diagnose, but very difficult to treat. And the mortality rate, if it's not treated up front, the mortality rate increases from 15% to well over 30%, and morbidity rate as well. The challenge is actually early diagnosis of sepsis. And there aren't any really good gold diagnostic standards. I mean, we really need to be able to diagnose sepsis earlier. And physicians have quite a challenge, because right now they're faced with having a number of clinical inputs that are associated with what they think is associated with sepsis. It could be certainly white blood cell counts. It could be fever. Could be a number of things that are happening, but at those early stages, it looks sepsis looks like what is another syndrome called systemic inflammatory response syndrome, and that is your body becomes hyper immune response, but actually it's ephemeral and goes away. There's no pathogen there, and if what we call that is SIRS. And at the early stage, if one is looking at SIRS, it's really difficult for them to be able to determine whether it's sepsis. And so they will rely on the gold standard has been blood culture, and that's associated with bacterial, but they don't get a result for 12 to 24 hours. So the default has traditionally been when in doubt, treat for sepsis. And by treating for sepsis, they will start putting broad spectrum antibiotics, and they'll be waiting for a result to determine whether there's really an infection or not. I mean, on the other hand, and one, you know, while physicians, if you speak to them, many of them say, I know sepsis when I see it. Very large epidemiological studies, over 10,000 physicians that were actually for ICU physicians that admitted and treated in the ICU for sepsis, 43% of the time they did not have it. And if they did not have sepsis, then these people, they're quite ill, and there's some other etiology going on. And that could be cardiovascular, it could be a brain bleed, it could be chronic pancreatitis. And in the case of a kidney patient with severe kidney disease, if you start treating with antibiotics, that could kill them. So on the one hand, it's really important to rule in sepsis, because as each hour goes by, and there truly is a sepsis cascade starting to happen, the mortality rate increases by 8% per hour. So it's very important. And of course, with these blood cultures, if you're waiting 12 to 24 hours, that's not a good sign overall. But on the other hand, if it's another etiology, the physician should be questioning whether or not they should be administering antibiotics. And we'll talk about antibiotic resistance probably later. Mm-hmm. But I think that they really need to get on that patient to find out what else is going on.
Yeah, I think you segued nicely onto a couple of things there. I mean, I want to come onto your technology, of course, a little bit later on, but since you mentioned antibiotic resistance, et cetera, I see this a lot when I do a little bit of reading into sepsis, that this comes up a lot. So can you tell us a little bit about the relationship as a result? Why is that a huge factor?
Well, antimicrobial resistance, or AMR, I mean, it's a naturally occurring phenomenon, but it can be accelerated, and we know it's being accelerated by indiscriminate use of antibiotics. And so that means overuse of antibiotics, over prescription of that. And certainly the NHS in the UK and CMS, Center for Medicare and Disease Service here in the US, has basically recognized that and really have programs in place to try to reduce the amount of antibiotics that are introduced. Because it's speculated that basically that drug-resistant infections, due to the fact that the antibiotics are not being, or that pathogens are not being controlled by the current antibiotics and future ones as well, the number of deaths that could occur would exceed those of the total number of cancer deaths in 2050. So this is a growing issue. And a lot of people aren't aware of it. Physicians certainly are, and hospitals certainly are. So there's programs that are out there to be able to try to reduce the number, the amount of antibiotic prescription, and particularly within a hospital. What is called nosocomial infections are sort of hospital acquired infections. So somebody comes into the hospital, they might be have surgery or something along those lines, but then after surgery, they could have an infection, and the likelihood of that of being something that's going to be a drug resistant pathogen is very, very, very high. The UK has done a great job, actually, of reducing, you know, antibiotic use in hospitals by about 15% between 2017 and 2021. US has reduced their use, but it still hasn't been sufficient, and we have a long way to go. So it's important to have technologies that are able to say, you know, one, you know, somebody has an infection. Well, an infection could be because of bacteria. They could be because of viral and fungal infections. And in fact, with COVID and the pandemic, 30% of COVID mortalities were due to viral sepsis in and of itself. But if you're treating a patient with antibiotics when you have a viral infection, that's not going to have utility. So there are technologies and that are evolving that directly detect viral infections or bacterial infections. And certainly, as you go down the into blood cultures, you could determine what is that bacteria, is it a resistant bacteria or not. But what certainly physicians are faced with, what do I do up front? How can I be able to make that sort of selection and get the right treatment for the right person?
Well, okay, let's come on to your technology in that context then, because if you're presented with a patient that might have sepsis or might not, how would you use your technology in the first place? So let's imagine ourselves in the healthcare environment. How would your test be used?
Certainly. Well, our test is we look and we're trying to do the early detection of sepsis. And so at that stage where I describe SIRS, where there's suspicion of sepsis, I've got two or three signs of sepsis, and well before organ dysfunction. And what our technology is, we found that we can measure the human host response to whether there's a systemic inflammatory response due to an infection or not. And so, and at that point in time, then what we do is we are looking at measuring gene expression, and it's RNA gene, mRNA, from white blood cells of the human. So we're not trying to detect the pathogen. What we're trying to do, we found that an earlier response is how is certain genes are activated or deactivated, depending upon whether or not you have a systemic inflammatory response with an infection, of which we have an activated gene, and then systemic inflammatory response, no infection. And that is due, and we actually have a gene that's lower expressed. And we measure the difference of that, and we have a score as a consequence of that called the SeptoScore. Our product's called Septocyte Rapid. And what we do is when there's a suspicion of sepsis, when a physician would say, I want to do a blood draw for blood culture, that's when you should do our test. Our test, basically, you take 1 mL of blood, the audience can't see this cartridge, but in my hand, I've got basically what is a cartridge that is a whole molecular lab in the palm of my hand. And one would put a mil of blood into this portal, close it, put it on an instrument that opens up like a DVD tray, closes, and then within 1 hour, we have a result. And we have a result that says there's a high probability of sepsis or a low probability of sepsis. And if it's a high probability of sepsis, you should definitely be treating that patient, you know, right away until you can identify what that that pathogen. But if we say there's a low probability of sepsis, you know what? You really should be looking at other etiologies, and perhaps you should not be administering broad spectrum antibiotics as a consequence.
I have a couple of questions in terms of, number one, the sample, because the cartridge that you showed to me there, and you haven't shown me exactly how you obtained it, but I'm imagining it's something like it wouldn't be dissimilar to like a finger prick test where you can actually almost drop the sample in. Am I right there, or am I right?
You actually are doing a blood draw. So, for example, if you're doing a classic where you go in phlebotomy, if somebody wants to have if a physician is asking, say, I want a metabolic workup, they would draw about 5 mL of blood. And so this would be taking 1 mL of blood and putting it in that cartridge. And then in that cartridge, it does all the extraction, the purification of the genes, measures, and then with the instrument. This is a molecular diagnostic test. We are able to do very sensitive PCR expression analysis of those genes. And then we put that in an algorithm, and we can tell you as to whether or not there's a high probability or not.
And with those probabilities, you're very careful to say it's probabilities. It's not like an absolute, because, well, anything could, there's no such thing as an absolute when it comes to these tests, I'm sure. But in terms of the accuracy, can you give us, has a number been put on it in terms of
how accurate? So we have FDA clearance, and we also have a CE mark. And what we have done, and with the FDA, is we have four bands, and if within these bands. And if you think about 100 patients, you know what our test will do is look at give a accurate assessment of about 80% of those patients. And if it says high probability, you're at about 90% percent specificity in diagnostic terms for that. And then the low end, you're at 95% probability that you don't have sepsis. And a third band, which represents about 20% of those patients, 20 patients out of 100, that's when you're faced with, I should look at these other etiologies and other measurements for the physician to make that call. And you know, that's much better than a flip of the coin, which is where things are at this point in time. There's action for the test.
It's fascinating that, I mean, we touched upon COVID and cartridges before, and obviously yours is different than what you showed me. But I do wonder about this trend of rapid testing coming to the fore, and it's probably been accelerated in the mind of the public because of COVID. Can you explain to our audience the differences that you would? That your test has compared to an at-home diagnostic, for example?
Yes, well, our test is really for at the hospital. By the way, we published two papers related to COVID and our determination whether or not we could detect COVID sepsis. But what was very interesting to note, so you know, for us is that we did a study where we were looking at patients, all COVID positive, who were presenting in the ED at the hospital. And as you know, it was very difficult to determine whether or not somebody would progress with severe COVID symptoms or be, you know, relatively okay, particularly before there were, you know, therapeutics that were there. And we found with our test is that if we had a high SEPTA score, that there was a very high percentage of those patients who, at the time, they're presenting, they're COVID positive, they have respiratory symptoms, but not severe, that within 2 or 3 days, they would end up in the ICU as a consequence. So we were predicting, you know, which patients would progress overall. We're not saying that we detect COVID. We're determining what the severity of that is. And so our test, and just to reiterate, is we really are differentiating early whether there's sepsis or not due to a pathogen, and it's independent of bacteria or viral or fungal. So the test result is very valid for all three. The next thing that people would want to know is, okay, there's an infection there. What is it, and how can they do that quickly? And in our pipeline, which is not regulatory cleared, we add to the test with genes that can determine whether it's due to a viral infection or a bacterial infection. So immediately when you have that there, then you know if it's bacterial, then yes, you should use antibiotics, right, for treating sepsis. But if it's a viral, the antibiotics aren't going to do you any good. So that in and of itself is going to be able to help be able to reduce the amount of indiscriminate antibiotic treatments.
It sounds as though from the answers that you're giving me that this is, that even though you've got something that's, you know, operating in the healthcare setting now, this is something that you're continuously refining and trying to improve as well. I'm just wondering, from the first idea, or when the idea first came about to now, I'm just wondering, how long has it taking you to get to this point, and what kind of work's got into it that you can disclose to our listeners?
Well, certainly the biomarker discovery and distillation took some time. It was interesting that, you know, we had hundreds of genes, you know, so to speak, that we saw that were either expressed, overexpressed, or underexpressed associated with that. The challenge is being able to whittle that down to something that would be a robust diagnostic test. And our first, and so that actually took probably about 4 years to be able to determine that we distilled down to four genes that really, really mattered in that regard. And once we had that, then we needed to do the clinical trials associated with that to see, is this indeed, can we validate that? And that took a good 2 years. The first test that we did was really in a lab-based test, which was, you know, I showed the cartridge, which was a lab in my hand, molecular lab. In the past, that would be three different clean rooms that would have to be done. And we demonstrated clinical utility, but that test took between 6 to 8 hours for a result. So we were looking at retrospectively, did we see that see sepsis earlier? That wasn't practical. So that's why we went and then developed and started developing in 2019 on what we call a sample to answer platform, which is what I had the cartridge in my hand. So that was basically, and you needed to have a turnaround time for clinical utility, to have a clinical turnaround time between 1 and 2 hours. Was very useful for a physician based upon our market research. So we developed that. We started developing that in 2019, and then we received FDA clearance at the end of 2022.
Okay, and you've got FDA clearance, you've got the CE mark. So, what's next for this innovation that you have?
Well, certainly. I mean, the company was a discovery and development house, and now we're commercializing, you know, at this point in time. And we have customers in the U.S., we have customers in Europe, but we're a very small company. So at the same time, we're trying to scale so we can be able to get the message out. We're doing sort of clinical utility. What are the clinical use cases for the test, of which is quite broad? One other stat is that normally if a patient has sepsis, they're treated and they're discharged from a hospital, the number one readmission rate for readmission into the hospital is due to a recurrence of sepsis. And so we've done studies that are ongoing in Europe that are demonstrating that if you have a high sepsis score and you're thinking of discharge, you probably shouldn't, because they're coming back. And in the U.S., hospitals are penalized very much for that, because they have to absorb the cost of those patients. The insurers will not do that. So that's just an example of a clinical use case. We're also expanding we have an adult indication, and we're moving into pediatric application. We're submitting to the FDA very shortly for that. Very high need for neonates and children. And then that follow-on, which I mentioned, was adding the bacterial and viral component to our test.
It sounds like you've got some exciting developments in the pipeline. Rolly, thank you very much for your time today. I just have one final question. It's something that I ask to everyone that comes onto the podcast, and that's if there's anything else that you'd like to add.
Well, all I'd like to add is the recognition of antibiotic stewardship, I think, is very, very important. And while I think in the medical community, people are aware of it, I think that across the board, this goes all the way to animal husbandry, what they're exposed to, you know, what we have in our food chain, et cetera, along those lines. We have to be able to manage that better. And we need to prevent that 2050 prediction that is out there. I mean, that's very significant. So the healthcare community and also the general population needs greater awareness and be able to mitigate this.
Okay. Well, Rolly, thank you for joining us on the MedTalk podcast.
Thank you, Ian. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.